Welcome to Total Picture Radio. I'm your host, Peter Clayton. Today's Career Strategies Channel podcast featuring Bob Callahan is brought to you by Jobs and Pods, a powerful social media recruiting tool where real employers talk about their jobs and how to get them. Jobcasts provide job advertising, employment branding, and employee recognition all on one platform. Visit jobsandpods.com and check out our Jobcast with Ryan Gordon, Advertising Director at Chronicle Media in Augusta, Georgia. Bob Callahan is Adjunct Professor of Business Administration for the Fuqua School of Business, Duke University, as well as an Adjunct Professor of Business for Columbia Business School, Columbia University. He is also the founder and CEO of a company called Business Improv. Welcome to a Career Strategies podcast on Total Picture Radio. I'm your host, Peter Clayton. I've been looking forward to talking with Bob for several weeks. I'm a huge fan of improv, and Bob was trained at the famed Second City in Chicago. And to name drop just a couple of people, he worked with Amy Poehler and Tina Fey. I love stand-up, too, and fortunately, Netflix continues to serve up a continuous stream of stand-up comedy specials. Added recently, I highly recommend a show called Three Mics with Neil Brennan. Okay, so Bob's company develops experiential learning programs for businesses. For over two decades, Bob has performed and taught improvisation with the most elite improvisers in the world. In addition to Second City, his teaching and performing credits include I.O., The Annoyance Theater, Columbia College, the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, UCLA Anderson School of Management, Columbia University Business School, Duke University's Fuqua School of Business, and universities in Istanbul and Australia. He has a new book called Getting to Yes and The Art of Business Improv, which has led him to Total Picture Radio. Bob, welcome. Glad to have you on the show.
Peter, thank you very much for having me.
As I mentioned in my intro, your company is called Business Improv. I'm sure you're asked this all the time, so let's address it immediately. What does improv have to do with business?
Well, I actually have an undergrad in business from the University of Illinois at Chicago, an undergrad degree, appropriately enough, that is a BS in business. And I started doing improv in high school and didn't know it was called improv. You know, improv in the late 80s really was not popular. No one really knew what it was. And so I just went on stage and called it making things up until people laughed. And then I got my college degree. And as I was in Chicago, I knew that Chicago had a great improv scene. I started taking classes there and left the world of business to pursue improvisation full time with passion and energy and focus, and burned through my savings account. And after doing everything in my power not to enter into business, I started up in business again, marrying improvisation, which I love tremendously, and business, which I also love tremendously, to create Business Improv.
Okay. In your book, you discuss debunking the myths regarding improv that many people assume improv means just winging it or I'm making it up as I go along. As you say, this is wrong, not even close. So define improv for us.
Sure. There are two major myths. One is that improvisation is only comedy. And though improvisational comedy surely is prevalent in today's society, specifically in America, of course, it's the context that creates improvisational comedy. So if you take the tenets of improvisation and redirect them, they can actually hit a number of different fields like first responders, EMTs, firefighters, special forces teams, as you and I communicated via email, sports teams, of course, improvise all the time, and business people improvise all the time. So myth number one is that improvisation is only comedy. That's not true. Improvisation is reacting, adapting, communicating in real time. Myth number two then really relates to the fact that the definition that improvisation is only what you do as a last-ditch effort when everything else goes wrong really dismisses the intelligence and training and focus and concentration that it takes to improvise at the top of your intelligence in real time. So rather than looking at improvisation as this ad hoc thing you do when the excrement hits the oscillator and it's a default, we should look at it as a set of skills that need to be sharpened and fine-tuned so that once it's time to improvise, we are doing it at the top of our intelligence to the very best of our ability. To be as clear as possible, improvisation thrives at the pivotal moment where planning and strategy meet execution.
Well, let's take planning and execution a little bit further. I've been reading your book on Metro North, which is helped shorten my trips into New York from Connecticut. And you tie sports into improv on numerous occasions. So sorry to the football fans in Atlanta. I have to bring up the Super Bowl because it's something that most people either watched or certainly heard about and have seen highlights of Super Bowl 51. In commenting on the game, Tom Brady said something like, "It certainly was not the way we drew it up." So Bob, would you add to the Super Bowl narrative one of the best improv performances of all time?
I think you can include really all professional sports under this umbrella. And I'm a Chicago guy, so I bleed first Cubby blue. So we can relate it back to the World Series, which I'm still celebrating in my heart and probably will for the next 10 years or so. And as a Bears fan, I can go beyond empathizing with the Falcons because we didn't even come close this year. So really looking at how Tom Brady defined the fact that they drew up plans and what actually happened at that moment goes back to what I said. It's planning and strategy meets execution, and there's where improvisation takes place. So on the football field, I think one of the classic ways to look at great improvisation as it unfolds is an audible. So what is an audible, Peter?
Well, it's when the quarterback, after seeing how the defense has lined up, shifts gears and changes the play from what it was originally intended to be.
Absolutely. So what you're pointing out right away is that there's a plan. There's practice, there's rehearsals, there's study, they know their offense, who's on their line, who's on their side, they know their defense. And then all of a sudden, at the line of scrimmage, Tom Brady in this case, his spidey senses go off and he says, "We have to change this plan." So he calls an audible, something they've practiced an awful lot. And the offense shifts. So now you watch the defense shift. Now the defense might have planned for something like this. They might be able to recognize it. Often, though, they don't really know the play that's about to unfold. And so you watch the defense react and adapt, i.e. improvise to what the offense just did. And then just to execute a single play, when hut, hut, hike is said, and the ball is now in Tom Brady's hand, you watch a number of small nuances of improvisation take place to either execute a plan successfully or break up the plan successfully if you're on offense or defense. So on any given play, you're going to watch improvisation take place, even though the play itself could have been very structured and set out.
Yeah, that's interesting and really provides a great analogy to your book and to improv. So let's get to the title of your book. What is the significance of yes and?
Yes and is the cornerstone of improvisation all around the world. Yes is unconditional acceptance. You give me this gift, this offer, this unexpected opportunity. I accept it at face value. It is what it is. This is what's happening or this is what's giving. I can't judge it in any way. I just have to deal with it. And then is the bridge to how you deal with it. And is the bridge to your reaction. And is the bridge to your intelligence. And is the bridge to your passion, your drive, your enthusiasm. So yes is unconditional acceptance and is the bridge to what you do with it. As you continue to break it down, though, it's important to look at the difference between yes and yes but. Yes but, the easiest way for me to define that is to go to a military axiom. And that axiom states, but eliminates everything said before it. Through restrictions, through denials, through contradictions, through steering, somehow but undermines what's being said right before it. In this case, the yes. And if it doesn't actually do that, it feels that way. Yes, but feels feels like a contradiction. It feels like an argument. It feels like you're undermining in some capacity. So the difference between yes, but and yes, and then is absolutely significant, because yes, but creates the feeling in other people that you disagree with them even when you agree with them. And yes, and creates the feeling that you're listening, you're focusing on them, you respect them, even if you inherently disagree with what they're saying. So now, as you continue to break the two of them down, you look specifically at yes and. Yes and is a communication tool as much as it is an ideation tool. And as a communication tool, it's a conflict management tool. And also as a communication tool, it's a way to slow the brain down to be focused and present in real time so that you are actively listening to what people are saying. It's also a direct roadmap to emotional intelligence and consequently a roadmap to mindfulness. So yes, and a very simple two-word phrase is an incredibly powerful multi-purpose tool.
And as you write in your book regarding yes, and, you know, an improv comedy scene may be a setup like someone is cooking dinner and the house catches on fire and says, oh, I'm cooking dinner, but the house is on fire. And then another actor goes, yes, and we better get out of here. So if that actor said yes, but, it would completely shut down the whole performance.
Absolutely, because but quite often acts as a negation. So it's almost as powerful for most people on the receiving end of it as a no. And in fact, yes, but is more dangerous than no more often than not, because yes, but feels like it's a polite no. It, at least that's what I used to hear quite often. Yes, but feels like a polite no to people, when in truth, it's not a polite no, it's a condescending no, wherein when said multiple times over the course of a relationship, you know, we're talking about week after week after week, or even done with passion, if you're really enthusiastic and you're screaming yes, but at people, it feels like a condescending no, because the smoke and mirrors of the yes part of it start to dissipate and people start to understand that what you're really doing is disagreeing with them. Even if you are agree with them, it feels like a disagreement. And so it becomes incredibly dangerous. And in an improv scene, the audience witnesses this in real time. And when you say something like a no or a yes, but towards somebody, and it completely halts the action, it undermines the person who just gave you this gift, this kitchen's on fire, and ultimately breaks down the scene itself. And the audience will turn on you super fast.
You know, Bob, the more I've thought about this, the more I absolutely agree with you. I think this is a real breakthrough for a lot of people who are listening to this and how to communicate with other people, because the word but can just absolutely close down the conversation. And like you said, it's rather condescending.
You know, I think it's important to point out, Peter, that it can be condescending. It can break things down. And the reason why I'm going to put this little asterisk on it is because really it's so much about relationships and context and situation, environment. And the way I'll break this down is, surely watching the game with some friends, having a couple of beers, you know, the Super Bowl, you're dressed differently, you're behaving differently, you're using different language than you would in front of a board of directors. So it's really about the situation. You can probably yes, but your best friend that you've known for 30 years, and that individual is not going to care at all. Whereas when you're building relationships outside of that more intimate context, you might need to be careful. And so for me, it's really about thoughtfulness, understanding that we have a choice. And the choice is, what kind of relationship do we want to build? Do we want to build one that's inclusive and feels like a collaborative, very respectful one with yes and, or do we want to build one that's exclusive, condescending, and shuts people down with yes but?
One of the techniques you describe in your book is called whole body listening. And when I was watching Neil Brennan's brilliant Netflix special, Three Mics, the term whole body performance popped into my head, because he switches from one-liners to stand-up to emotional in his body language, facial expression, everything changes. So what do you mean by whole body listening?
Whole body listening really means that you are focused and paying attention to the very best of your ability with 100% of your body. And at the same time, you're watching and picking up the nuances of what somebody else is saying to the very best of your ability and their whole being. So the best way to really start breaking this down is by pointing out that the human brain can process between 350 and 550 spoken words a minute in the English language. And most people speak around 120 words a minute, which means that the brain has this extra power that most people use to actually start going inside their own head and thinking about what they're going to say next while somebody else is talking to them. And for most people as well, they start forming questions. So we disengage from a conversation to go inside our own head to form questions that we can use to re-engage in the conversation and keep the conversation going. So what I want to throw out is, instead of going internally in your own head and think about what you're going to say next, go externally. Push all of your energy on the person across from you. Really focus on engaging the person across from you. Read their nonverbal communication from their facial expressions to their body gestures, and allow that to influence how you are going to attempt to influence them to keep them engaged, to keep them in the moment. And this takes a lot of effort to be that focused and that present in real time, because the human brain is so powerful, it will disengage at any given time. So the matter is not, can you stay engaged 100% of the time? Can you find that you've disengaged faster than other people can? And can you re-engage at a different level that they can as well, to build that relation, to keep other people engaged, to keep them focused? And this takes all of your body. And if you are really that aware, once again, in the spirit of yes and, link into mindfulness of your own behavior, then you can change your behavior in real time to influence the people across from you. So if you're standing, for example, with your arms crossed and you're looking out the window, or you pull out your phone and you start checking it for whatever reason that doesn't have anything to do with the conversation, and you catch yourself doing that, then you can make the conscious decision to stop looking out the window, to unfold your arms so it's more open to the person across from you, to put your cell phone down so that you are making eye contact with the person who's trying to engage you, and make sure that that conversation, that engagement is one that's impactful.
I think that provides a excellent segue to my next question. So Bob, can you walk us through one of your corporate workshops or training sessions? I would imagine you get a fair share of skeptics like, what has HR done now? Am I right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I started Business Improv for just about 17 years ago, 18 years ago. And I could tell you about the evolution of skepticism in the last 17, 18 years. That especially when I started at 27 years old, I would go into an organization, and if I had the fortune and opportunity to work with senior level executives, they would essentially roll their eyes at me and say, what does this kid know about anything, let alone business? And what does improv have to do? And as improv became more popular, now you have to think back, 1999, 2000, what did you think of when you heard the word improv? And for most people, they didn't even think of it at all. It just wasn't part of mainstream America, because it was not even accepted in Hollywood in the early aughts. It wasn't until the mid-2000s that Hollywood itself said, okay, we can put your Curb Your Enthusiasms up there. We can use improv elements in all sorts of different places. It was too risky before that, before Whose Line Is It Anyway started proving it was popular. And that had to take longevity. It couldn't be a one-off 1 year, because improv already had such a negative connotation. And that connotation still exists. So when I go into businesses now, especially working with high-ranking, very powerful people, the first thing that we need to do is redefine improvisation more often than not by addressing those two myths that we had before. Create a common definition of what improvisation is, and then really lay the agenda out as clearly as possible, so that those very intelligent people, which not only the skeptics fall under the umbrella of rank and status, they actually also fall into the spectrum or hemisphere of right brain versus left brain. So you get the more analytical, research-oriented, scientific type of minds. And they actually use one side of the brain as a safety zone. very often, that they feel more comfortable over here and they don't want to get over into this other side. And what we need to do over and over again is show that the brain is one organism and we have to use both sides of the brain all the time. So creative people have to be able to make sense of numbers and even execute equations, and numbers people have to be able to communicate and talk with people and sometimes even craft their numbers into memorable stories to have greater impact. And so we have to be able to communicate on all levels across the board. Once all of this is put into place, those skeptics really start to think a little bit. And that's what we ask across the board. It's okay to enter with skepticism. Put that skepticism inward as well to make sure that you are standing on the base that you think you're standing on, or that you actually are standing on, rather than one that you perceive to be correct.
I would imagine that most of the consulting and workshop work that you do within corporations is within teams and not individuals. Is that correct?
Most of it is with teams and not with individuals. That said, I, over the last half a dozen years, have found myself one-on-one and one-on-two coaching fairly regularly.
I would imagine that that goes back to what you were talking about earlier, in that improv is now very much mainstream and everyone knows what improv is and how it works and is more accepted out there. It's like, you know, when I started this podcast in 2005, no one knew what the hell a podcast was. And now it is fairly mainstream. Thank you, Serial and NPR and other podcasters out there, and it's far more accepted.
It's becoming more accepted, and I like this parallel to podcasts, because I think podcasts are becoming much more accepted as well, and you are much more the expert in this field of podcasts than I am, so I'm actually going to ping this back to you. Do you find actually that the evolution of podcasts is at its zenith, or it still has a way to go?
Oh, I think it still has a long way to go. That said, you know, 199 million people in the United States now own a smartphone. And of course, that's the way most people engage in, you know, in podcasts and in that type of media. And of course, the newer smartphones have very fast processors, which has also led to, you know, the whole increase in video viewership over the internet, because the bandwidth is so much better. So, yeah, I think there's a long way to go with podcasts and with other kinds of consumable media that is easily accessible over tablets and smartphones and the types of devices that people are now using to learn and entertain. But focusing on the entertainment aspect of this and taking this back to improv and to the title of your book and the concept of yes and, all of this requires thought and practice. And if someone just reads your book and never actually puts into practice any of these concepts that you're discussing, then, you know, it's not going to do you any good.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I can't stress this enough. I mean, if you really want to get to the point that I think, if I'm going to continue this parallel, with the podcast element, that it's second nature to you and you could wash dishes and yes and people, even yes and yourself, you know, while doing a secondary or tertiary task, that your mind is really focused on cleaning the house, and yet in the back of your head you're thinking about this proposal that you have to write, and you just enter that yes and state and you're just coming up with ideas and every once in a while dropping them down. That has to come from practice. You have to get so comfortable using these tools and techniques in improvisation that they are now second nature to you. And it's like knife work if you're in the kitchen, or flavor profiles if you like to cook, or equations as they get more and more complex, or I would even roll the dice to say as well, interviewing in a podcast, that the first interviews were probably not the same as the 50th interviews and probably not the same as the 500th interviews. It's just a different level of comfort that comes from practice and repetition. And in that practice and repetition, authenticity, you know, lies in wait, and your voice truly gets to come out once you own that skill set.
Right, right. And Bob, another myth around podcast is that, you know, millennials don't have the attention span to listen to long form podcasts. But when you look at some of the most popular shows, like Tim Ferriss, his shows often run almost 2 hours. And Mark Maron's WTF has always been one of the most popular podcasts since he started. And his shows always run an hour. So the idea that millennials don't have the patience to listen to long form content, I think is really false. Look at how often they binge watch TV series on Netflix.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of the joke now, right? You skip it's not just millennials. I think a lot of people, you skip the whole season so that over the course of a weekend, you can just sit and eat garbage food and catch up on all the shows that you missed. I mean, when my son was born, I was up, I had the, we'll call it midnight shift, the 3 or so until my wife gets up block so that she could finally rest. And, you know, he's of course fed already. And that's how I watched The Wire. It was night after night after night, bouncing on a yoga ball and trying to get my son to sleep with earphones on and, you know, binge watching The Wire. So it's not just millennials. And tangentially, I think millennials are getting a bad rap. You know, I am fortunate in that because I've worked with the MBAs for most specifically and regularly at Duke Fuqua School of Business. We've just had our 18th iteration of it. So over the last 17 calendar years, 18 programs, I've watched millennials grow and turn into millennials in 18 years. And improvisation as a whole, it's pretty much a young person's game. So the men and women who continue to enter into the field of improvisational acting are staying in the age bracket that they're in. And us older people start transitioning not only just from performing now into like business improv in my case. And their focus and concentration, their passion, their intelligence is right on par with every other one, including mine, which is Gen X, which is always for me like the laziest name to give a generation. It's like, we don't know what to call you guys, so we'll just call you X, an undefined variable. That's how lazy we are in naming you. We don't even know what you are, so you're X.
Right, the forgotten generation.
Yeah, they're all going to be forgotten generations. Every single one of us is a forgotten generation. So I think it's not that there is a generation that's behaving one way or another way. It's people inside of it. And like you just said, if the content is there and the purpose is there, then it could be a 3-minute venue. It could be a 60-minute podcast. It could be 15 hours of programming, and we're going to watch it.
Agree. A chapter of your book that I think would be of particular interest to my audience is your chapter on branding, specifically personal branding, which has been so overused that it's really become cliche. So you write, branding really stems from one key attribute, awareness. Can you expand on this concept for us, please?
So such a huge part of improvisation is about being aware. You know, that's what that focus and concentration is. If you're going to react to something, you have to be aware of that to which you are reacting and specifically adapting as well and communicating. So it's so much of it's about awareness. Now, with personal branding, what I'm telling you to do is focus on yourself. What brand do you have? How do you comport yourself? How are you composed? What language do you use? How do you influence the people around you? And that's the big element with this personal branding. It's to give yourself the opportunity to give a proper 360 and even get some outside feedback about the brand that you currently have. And then through consistency of behavior, you will then change your brand to influence the people the way that you want to influence them. Again, not the way that you think you're influencing them, the way that you desire to, so that that ultimate influence, that impact is even greater. And if you're not aware of your behavior, if you're not aware of the language that you use, then you, I would say, completely challenge the fact that you're going to make an intelligent, cognizant decision on how to change. Because how do you make the decision to change if you don't know where you are or what's happening? And this is how it links to mindfulness as well. It's that slowing the brain down to be present, to be mindful. You know, mindfulness is based so heavily in emotions of yourself and how you affect other people. What the language we use in getting to yes and is a self-audit. And that's that awareness that you're talking about, the ability to recognize what you're doing in real time so that you can make the conscious decision to continue that behavior or change that behavior so that you impact the people around you the way that you want to impact them. And it's about choice as well. And that, to me, I agree that, I thought about this heavily, actually, if I wanted to call that chapter personal branding. And the reason why I stuck with it is because it is about choice. We can brand ourselves. We can create the character. And I don't mean a two-dimensional character that you'd see in a cartoon. I mean the metal of who we are as people. We can create that as much as we can fall into it through habit.
We spend a lot of time on this show talking about employee engagement, or actually the lack thereof. The statistics are unbelievably abysmal, especially in large corporations. So how can an improv mindset help managers and executives with engagement?
Peter, I think the best way I can answer this is to address it with two responses. The first one goes back to an adage that I adapted from something that my mentor taught me. My mentor created the Second City Training Center, a wonderful man named Martin DeMont. And he used to say, to be interested is to be interesting. And the extension that I'm going to take with that is to be engaged is to be engaging. So as leaders, if we're really focused on engaging the people we lead on a regular basis, they're going to be engaged by us. And the ramifications of this, at least, again, will be an increased probability that they're going to be engaged overall. The second way then is to create a culture of engagement. And this is, for us in improvisation, an open culture wherein, at least for periods of time, and I'm going to qualify that to say, I'm not necessarily saying that you should do this 100% of the time. I'm saying for strategic periods of time, you create an environment in which ideas are shared and people feel valuable for sharing their ideas and valued for sharing the ideas. And the ideas, just as ideas, good, bad, or ugly, are valued and valuable as well. So it's a postponement of judgment to create an open, collaborative, communicative environment in which people want to share ideas. So now we're talking, if you're going to say want, intrinsic motivation. They are intrinsically motivated on their own to communicate with you because that's the culture that's laid out, and people adapt to fit into culture. We want to be part of great teams. We want to be part of a great culture. So when you create this culture this way, people will adapt their personality to fit inside this culture and thrive inside this culture. Now, by having this open, communicative, collaborative environment in which people are intrinsically motivated to share ideas on their own without extrinsic motivation, bonuses, vacations, extra days off, whatever it might be, what we find is that people start buying in not only to the culture and the team and the project and the process, they are building in to the culture, team, product, and process. And that extra participation wherein they're contributing to the greater success, the greater purpose, creates that overall commitment and loyalty that we're looking for engagement.
Back to millennials for a minute here, Bob. A lot of the people in the learning and development community whom I've spoken with over the last year or so, talk about the importance of coaching and learning opportunities and personal development. It's as important to millennials as their salary.
I think that's true for a lot of people, to be honest with you. You know, it's personal development and personal growth is part of evolution. You know, we as humans do not become stagnant. If you're stagnant, you die. I mean, that's your ultimate demise. Otherwise, we continue to change. That is just part of the all living creatures. They go from young babies to old adults. And if you can grow along the way, then you actually create that type of bond, that chemistry with people. So coaching and learning and development is a way to stimulate those who you lead. And in doing so, you can create that loyalty again in that relationship.
Well, another hot topic in the recruiting and HR world is retention. And I think a lot of what we've been talking about in terms of engagement really falls into the retention world as well.
Absolutely. You know, it's been proven many times over that for the extreme majority of companies, it's more cost efficient and effective to retain talent than it is to constantly have to find, replace, train new talent. And so in so much of what we're talking about, if you go back to what we just hit in the employee engagement aspect, we're talking about how to retain talent. And that drive that you're talking about is that sense of purpose, that desire to belong. You know, it's a basic human desire to be understood, or at least believe that people understand us. And that's part of that sense of belonging. That's part of that sense of purpose. And that is that greater overall drive that so many people are looking for, something bigger than themselves to which they can contribute the greater success and feel valuable and valued for that contribution. And that type of commitment and that type of engagement creates a tremendous amount of loyalty. And also, in the spirit of retaining employees, that old adage, you don't quit jobs, you quit people, has a lot of truth to it. That many people like their jobs and will go off hunting for another job because they don't like the person or people with whom they work. And if there is a way as intelligent leaders to be thoughtful about the way we behave, to make sure that we are retaining top talent, especially if they're incredible, driven, hardworking, enthusiastic, passionate people, then it would behoove us to explore and learn how to succeed using those techniques.
Here's a question I bet you get from a lot of CFOs. What is the ROI? Do you have any numbers around organizations that adopt a more improvisational culture?
We're working on creating those documents that show the numbers. So as research that's still very much in the production stage, what I can certainly tell you, though, without a shadow of a doubt, is that this is so impactful that for many organizations, we are going in and helping redesign their culture so that when new employees come in, they adapt to fit inside that open, collaborative, communicative culture. And once again, it's important to underscore that creating an open, collaborative, communicative culture does not mean that you never say the word no. You have to operate within the law. You have to operate within budgets, safety issues. There's a lot of reasons to say no. This is about being thoughtful about when you say no or what happens when you say yes, but versus when you block off a period of time in which there's a free exchange of information and ideas and what happens from there. So a couple quick examples of this are Sela, which is a consultancy that's based in technology and has multiple offices and is growing rapidly. Every year they double in size. This year they're going from 300 to 600 people. And we've worked with everybody in their organization across the board, from the most senior ranking people to the new hires to maintenance engineers and technicians and assistants. So everybody understands this so that they're using the same language and put the same rituals in place. They put the same actions in place. And ultimately, through that type of repetition of behavior and accountability practices, they are not only changing the culture that previously existed, they're creating foundational blocks on which they continue to build their culture for new hires as they come in.
To quickly follow up on that, I'm going to borrow a chapter title from your book, How to Eat an Elephant. So to change a culture requires buy-in from the CEO, does it not?
More often than not, yes. Now, there's a lot of CEOs, though. The reason why I said more often than not is that they're really interested in being productive and perhaps even the bottom line and making sure the shareholders are happy. So I think everything goes on a case-by-case basis. What I would say, though, is that if the leadership is not buying into the change and practicing the change, then nobody else will. You know, we have to walk the talk. We lead by example. The lip service will only go so far, and the lip service should support our actions, and our actions have to support the lip service. At the beginning of getting to Yes And, I put a little phrase in there, which I mean tremendously, that I believe wholeheartedly in grassroots efforts. I think they're very real. However, grass won't grow when somebody's standing on it. So it's up to us to understand as leaders where we're standing and the impact we have on those that are under us.
Getting to Yes and the Art of Business Improv is published by Stanford University Press. Bob, how can our listeners connect with you?
You can connect with me via Twitter at Callahan or my Facebook author page, and I will definitely get back to you if you have questions or comments, concerns, if you need additional support. You can also reach me via my website, businessimprov.com, and of course, if you get the book, I'd love to hear what you have to say. So, Peter, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Bob. And thanks for tuning in to Total Picture Radio. You can find Bob's interview in the Career Strategies channel of Total Picture Radio. While there, sign up for our newsletter to stay up to date on all the current topics and awesome guests contributing to this podcast. Today's show with Bob Callahan was brought to you by Jobs and Pods. It's a podcast, it's a jobcast, a blog, and a YouTube video, all on one platform where real employers and staffing agencies advertise their jobs and tell you how to get them. If you're looking for a mobile-first employment branding and social recruiting marketing solution where your job posting will have a real voice, talk to me about Jobs and Pods. Mention TPR when you book your first jobcast for a $50 discount. We invite you to join the conversation on our Facebook page, facebook.com/RealJobcasts, and follow us on Twitter at Jobs and Pods. This is Peter Clayton. You'll find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Total Picture Radio's Facebook group. Have a great week.